look unusually happy, even for your usual happy self. You must have had a great weekend.
Brad, I had a weekend of carpentry, and I could not be happier. I had this idea. People are going to laugh at me. So I've been doing San Diego Comic-Con now for 25 years, since 1998, something like that.
Yeah.
Consistently going every year. And I have my booth. It's a corner booth at Comic-Con. And I have every square inch of that booth accounted for, right? So I know exactly where to put things and exactly how to set it up and exactly what kind of I need for bookshelves and stuff like that. Anyway, I had these specific pin racks that I got, and they work great. But I was like, you know what? This year, I'd like to lift them up a little bit so they're a little more in eye line, but you can still talk to an adult over the top of the pin rack. So I did a bunch of measurements, did a bunch of math. Bought the wood, and this weekend I spent dang near my whole weekend building this really cool little rack that I can store books underneath and have a cash drawer underneath. And to the public facing thing, the pins are going to be displayed really nice. Brad, it was the bee's knees. I'm so happy to have done it.
That's so cool that you can. I mean, that's really kind of a testament to how long you've been doing this show. And it's the one show that you do now. You've pretty much stopped doing most of your other shows.
Yes.
But you've got it right down to the last pica, where you've got every square inch, and you can just basically measure this out and I know from you showing me on FaceTime, it's got a bunch of hidden compartments in it so that you can do stuff like restocking and all this.
Yes.
Put an amazing amount of thought into this, and I can see it just fitting like a Lego right into where it's supposed to be.
Oh yeah.
And then you take off from there.
It's like, you know those videos of people in, they're either in Tokyo or in New York that have a 300 square foot apartment, and they fit like seven rooms in one three, because it's all like compartmentalized and multi-leveled and there's storage under the stairs and this and that. I have this, but it's also part of like, not to sound too happy clappy, but I genuinely love the act of being a cartoonist going to Comic-Con. I love it. And so for me, it's super fun to spend my weekend building this thing that's going to go, and I still have to patch and paint it, but I'm going to build it and put it up in Comic-Con, and I love it. I genuinely love it. Like, it brings me joy to make this thing for Comic-Con.
That's awesome. And I got to tell you, I am in awe of your ability to do that, because I'm not a woodworker. You know, I couldn't do that stuff. And it's just so cool to think that you say, okay, I need this one certain thing. It's got to fit right here. And then you just create it. It's amazing to me.
Here, and you have a little bit tipped your hat too much, because you let me know that you're not a woodworker when you, that you are perhaps a digital worker when you said, oh, you have that booth planned down to the last pica. And I was like, well, there's a guy that does not do a lot of woodworking.
I actually, it's so funny you mentioned that. Pica is something we use in newspapers all the time.
Right.
And I remember getting introduced to a newspaper designer, and I said, we were at his house. I said, how long have you been designing newspapers? And his wife interrupted and said, you see that back deck out there? And I go, yeah. She goes, he built that back deck. I said, well, yeah, but what does that have anything to do with? She interrupted me. She says, he measured it in picas.
No, he did not. He measured it in picas?
that back deck was measured in picas, because he, at that point in his life, he could not think in any other measurement.
Oh,
it just made sense to him.
Oh, my God. Measured it. Well, I was not that bad. I got to say, though, what I will say to all of our European and international friends, I have become a convert to the metric system, because now I do my woodworking in metric. And holy hell, it's such a better system. Why do we not use it? I do not know why we've kept the English system. It is
you
so...
mean you don't miss doing 7/16 of an inch?
Oh my God, it's so fucking medieval and cattywampus. Yes. It's like, oh, well, I'll take 4/8 of a gram of a cat's whisker. And like, that's what our measurements are now. It's like, well, we take 3 witches' brooms and half that and 4/32 of a stone. And you're like, what is
and
going
all because
on?
In, all because in the 70s, no one was going to tell us how to measure. We were all set to switch over in the 70s. I remember getting the books in school. And then there was it. We're not going to do what they tell us to do. We're Americans, damn it. Burp. And that was it. The 70s came and went. We never switched to the metric system. And here we are measuring 8/32nds of an inch.
All because some Texans took a shotgun to the metric signs on freeways. We gave up completely, and then we lost 2 Mars probes because of that. And anyway, yeah. I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a few centimeters ahead in making a living from comics, I'm Brad Geiger, the editor of the Webcomics Handbook on Substack and the creator of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon, who also has to go look up the definition of the word pika. Not quite sure, but I co-directed the documentary strip as well.
You keep calling it pika. I'm going to keep reminding
is
you
it it's pika? Pika.
God damn it, say it right. And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave! Let's talk comics.
I will say the pronunciation of pika, it sounds like some kind of 1930s slur. You know what I mean? Like,
it kind of does.
That guy over there, he's a real pika. You know, you're like, what? Is that vaguely racist? I don't know what that phrase is.
Well, it sounds like piker, right? Which was not a slur, but it was an insult. Oh, that guy is a real piker over there.
That's why my brain thought it was a...
So like with a Brooklyn accent, that guy is a piker.
Yeah, exactly.
Which actually turned out more Boston, but I don't do accent.
Brad and Dave, you're two friends for good regionalisms and accents. Well, speaking of language changing and things changing in general, let's do this, Brad. Let's talk about our first topic for the week, which is changing rates on Patreon. You and I have both had, let's talk about it, a long, dark tea time of the soul in terms of changing the rates on Patreon. And I want to say kudos to my friend Brad, who faced down his demons and did what had to be done. Brad, do you want to tell everybody the course of events and how it all came to happen?
I'm going to tell you, I'll just start by thanking my friend Dave Kellett, who talked me off the ledge more times in the last 30 days than I've ever been talked off in my life. When it came to raising, so starting at the beginning, we decided, both of us had kind of decided, listen, it's time to raise the rates on our Patreon.
Keeping in mind, by the way, that Brad and I have been on there for 9 years or so, right? Like this is not like a sudden thing, right?
I started in 2014. And so I was like, it's time to do it. And because at certain points I'm like, I've just got to do it. Mm-hmm. From a business standpoint, yes. I had to raise that rates. That $10 wasn't as $10 as it once was. It's not worth that $10 that I'm making for my main Patreon level is not worth $10 anymore.
Right.
So I finally decided I need to pull the trigger on this. And I ended up, unbeknownst to me, even before, and Dave had to point it out to me, I ended up struggling with the greatest bout of imposter syndrome that I probably have had in my entire life. Over a $2 price increase, by the way, from $10 to $12.
Yes, it's true, yeah.
Don't think for a minute that $11 wasn't considered for an awful long time, and $10.50 was on the table for a not insignificant amount of time, but it finally came up to $12.
Yes.
I was ready to pull the trigger, and I found myself dealing with imposter syndrome like you would not believe.
Yeah. And to the point where I said, you know what? Run it by me in terms of the copy that you're going to communicate to your readers. Like, just send me the update and let's, you know, keep it short, Brad, keep it short and pithy and try to get out, you know, in 4 or 5 sentences why you're doing it and what's happening and that people have an out if they don't want it. And Brad goes, yeah, that's good. I'll do a write-up. I'll do a write-up. That's fine. And I can't emphasize enough how in this process, Brad was like, just sweating, just actively sweating, even as we're FaceTiming one another. And he's like, yeah, that's a good idea. I'll write a little write-up. And so a day or two goes by and I get this email that Brad is going to send to his update as his update. And when I use the phrase Russian novel, I don't use that lightly. It was perhaps 48 paragraphs long. I don't know how much more he could have written.
I just pulled up the document. It was 572 words long. It was when I say that it was long, it was like it felt like I was asking Mary Sue Simmons out to the prom, and I was going to give her all of the reasons that I was going to be a good date.
It was absolutely that energy of the 17-year-old unsure about asking somebody out on a date, and here's all the reasons why you should go with Brad Geiger to the prom. That's exactly the energy you were giving off. It was also the energy of like a 26-year-old employee for a big company with all the reasons why he should have a raise after 2 years going into their boss. Well, I just feel like I've really put in the effort, and I hope that everyone sees that I've been working extra hours. I mean, imposter syndrome is the right word. Brad just could have said, hey, gang, you know what? It's been 10 years. You love Evil Inc. I'm doing my best and we're all having fun here. But you know what? Inflation has kind of come for us all. Time to raise rates. If you don't like it, here's how you can opt out. And bada bing, bada boom, you're done. Cut to Dave Kellert reading paragraph 48. And so when Mars is rising in conjunction with Jupiter, we see that sometimes prices need to be adjusted. You're just like, what's happening?
I had subheads. I had subheads. I had, first of all, two paragraphs.
Yes. Yeah,
two
have graphs. Oh my God, you had graphs.
Yes, I had two paragraphs of introduction. Right. And because your support has made this last decade possible, it's important then that number one, I explain how I made this decision. Number two, how you can lock in a lower rate for the next year, which, by the way, we're going to talk about too. And number three, what you'll get when you continue your patronage.
Right.
Then the first subhead, why the price change? Then there's a paragraph there. Why $12, Dave? I had to explain, or I felt I needed to explain.
Oh my God.
Why it was $12. And then I pulled up a graph from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Oh, fucking yes, you dumb guy.
That showed that $10 was basically in 2015. $10 now should be $13.42. And I pointed out that if I truly had kept up with inflation, it would be $13.42, but I'm just asking for $12. Oh, I'm not even keeping up with inflation. I wanted to make that point too. And then I told them how you can lock in the rate.
Yes.
Now, by the way, I kind of stand, that one I kind of stand by, but here's the deal. Before I pulled the trigger on this, I wrote to Patreon support and I said, since this is relatively new, I want to make sure I understand this correctly. When I raise my rate from $10 to $12, do I have it understood correctly that my existing patrons can lock in that $10 a month rate if they switch to an annual subscription before the 31 days have elapsed?
Right.
When you up your rate, you've got 31 days grace period that everyone's got that time to adjust their subscription. They can cancel. They can do this. They can do that. So within that 31 day time period, if my $10 backer locks into a annual subscription, can they get that lower rate? I got the response from Patreon support, which I've saved and screenshotted for reasons that we're going to get into later, saying absolutely, they have 30 days to lock in that old rate. Fan-freaking-tastic. And by the way, I also, like most of us, have a little discount. A 10% discount.
Which is smart. We recommend that. Yep.
If you subscribe at the annual rate, you get 10% off. So I pointed out that if you wanted to lock in that rate, you could become an annual subscriber.
Which, by the way, even that is imposter syndrome, but keep going. Yes.
Oh, I know. By the way, Dave, go ahead.
I was going to say there was we're saying this because both Brad and I, 25 years in, still suffer from imposter syndrome. So we're sharing this with you, not to embarrass one another, but to tell you that we suffer from this too, because I'll tell you what else Brad did. Not only did Brad write an O. Henry short story for everyone in terms of like the diatribe that he went on and why it was worth it to keep backing Evil Inc.
Yeah.
He also said, recommended to people, hey, lock in the price at the lower price before, like, God forbid he actually get the money that he's asking for. So he recommended to people that they lock in the cheaper rate before he himself raised the rates. So he did that. And then the third thing was, he's like, oh, and by the way, if you choose to stay, I've got 48 free ebooks I'm going to give to everybody because God forbid that the Patreon is worth it in and of itself. I got to give you 17 more things. So it was all like imposter syndrome on top of imposter syndrome. And God bless him, because I soon thereafter did it myself, I know of which I speak. I felt it as well in terms of raising rates.
I was going to do a special offer, which that you successfully talked me out of doing. But my special offer would have basically given people that stayed 300 pages of my top content.
Right.
300 pages in a special offer. So if you stick around, which, by the way, you know the move, then they stick around just long enough to get the download code.
But it also, you know, this is just what it reads as. And gang, here's a special offer if you stick around. Please love me. That's a special offer. Oh, dear God. Just please love me.
Yes. Oh, and we're not done yet. We're still, by the way, you think this email's over? This email's not over. We're only at the halfway mark, because then I had to go in and list all of the things that you get with your subscription. The posts that I make here nearly every other day, an archive of 1,500 not safe for work posts, exclusive access to the exclusive areas of the Evil Inc. website, the monthly loot crate rewards, special offers, bonus. I had 10 bullet points of what people are going to get that they're already getting, but I got to remind them what they're getting, because they don't know what they're getting. And still we're not done. And then, of course, now this Dave and I agree, you've got to tell them how to adjust their pledge. That's fair baseball.
Yeah, that's
and
fair
Patreon
that's
themselves
fair
will tell you, you've got to tell people how they can adjust their pledge if they want to tell you. And I did that, and that was the original version of the email or the post that I was going to send out to Patreon backers. And Dave's like, dude, we're talking four sentences. You've got four thoughts you want to get across.
At best, by the way, most people aren't probably going to read the four sentences, but
yes. That was your point. They're not going to read past that first. Once they see the prices going up, they're either in or they're out.
Right, exactly. They get what inflation is. They get it.
Yep. And yes, you don't want to, in a subscription business model, you don't want to remind people that they're subscribing.
Right.
But at the same time, you've got to, and we got to the point where we're both like, we got to adjust that price. So I was busily trying to, pare down that epic love poem that I'd written to my readers. Dave over the weekend surprises me, and I get an update from him saying, listen, he goes, I know this is absolutely driving you bonkers. I'm going to do mine first, and you can see how my readers react, and then you're going to know it's okay.
Yeah, because bigger background, Brad was terrified that he was going to lose X number of followers or backers or whatever you want to describe them as soon as he pulled the trigger. And both of us had done the math on how many people can we afford to lose at the new price and still at the bare minimum maintain the same income we had prior to this, right? And for Brad, it was like, well, I could lose 150 people at the new price. And I'm like, Brad, that's not going to happen. Tops, you're going to lose 10 people. I don't know. This just seems like a real risky roll of the dice, Dave. And so I over the weekend, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to pull the trigger. I'll do it. And then within a couple of days, Brad will see how many I lost. And for a price change that was impacting on Drive, I think it was like 500 people. I think I lost five, I think. I haven't looked at the updated numbers. Two automatically bumped themselves up to a higher level. Uh-huh. One person jumped up two levels. It was fine. It was all fine. And so I was so glad that A, Brad nudged me to do this, and B, that I nudged myself to do it before Brad to help him jump off the cliff.
And when I finally got my post down to a manageable resource, took out the special offer, took out the begging and the pleading, took out the chart, the graph from the Bureau of Labor Statistics proving the inflation rate of $10, oh my God. Took all of that stuff out and made it, again, like Dave said, very matter of fact, here's what's going on. And I'll talk about my results in a second, but I will say this real quick. To be fair, I saw Dave makes this announcement, and I saw the first person that responded. What was your change was from like $2 to $3, right?
Yeah, because I had a low bare bone support level that was $2 for like the last 9 years, and I was like, you know what, time to go to three. Not a big deal. Not a big deal at all.
It's a dollar. The first person to respond was, well, that's a 50% increase. I'm out of here. And I'm like, oh my God.
Brad's heart goes through his throat.
It never fails. It never fails. Yes, on paper, it's a 50% increase. It's a dollar. It's a dollar. Go out and tell me what you can buy for a dollar today, you know, but it's a 50% increase. I followed it very closely, Dave, because then the next person that came in focused on the fact that you've been doing this for a decade. And that person said, oh my gosh, you've been doing this we've been participating in this thing that brings joy to our lives for a decade. Yeah. That's amazing. And this one person just turned the whole conversation around. All of a sudden, the conversation was about Dave's community that he built and what a wonder it's been for 10 years.
Well, and this goes to the efforts that we should all make to generate a community that's based on kindness and support and friendliness, is that within minutes of that first person complaining, I had 10 other people in there going, well, this is no big deal at all. I'm so happy to support. In fact, I'm going to bump myself up and this and that, all this other stuff, and all the reasons why they love Drive and it was great. And how did I make it so affordable for people to back it? And, you know, it was like, it was genuine, it was kind, and it was supportive. And it was everything you hope for. And honestly, 25 years of working online, both Brad and I can tell you that there is always a squeaky wheel, and they will find a chance to complain if you slightly tweak your line art, if you go from black and white to color, if you slightly change the layout of your website, if you change from posting on Thursdays to Friday, if you go from posting a single panel to two panels. Like, no matter what you do, any kind of change, someone will complain. It's almost always a dude, because for whatever reason, dudes have feel like they have a right to complain more than women do. I don't know why, but they always are a squeaky wheel, and you can just ignore them because it's like, it's sort of a truism that's across the internet. Someone will complain, and don't focus on them. Focus on the kindness and support and the overall general good feeling that you get from your community.
Oh yeah. I've said before, when I made the switch to color, the first thing I got the biggest outpouring of anger when I went from a black and white to a color strip. They'll complain about everything. And we've said before, on a Kickstarter, the person that's going to complain loudest is the person that's at the lowest tier.
Oh my God, is that true?
That's an immutable fact, that the people that are buying in for the least amount of money are the biggest complainers.
Yes, and it speaks probably to wealth, but I'll have backers that are backing at like the $500 or $700 level in the Kickstarter. Nary a peep. No complaints at all. But by God, the person that backed at the $5 digital only level is like, how dare you, sir, for the two-day delay in delivering that. You're like, what's wrong, my friend? Listen, let me pull you aside and give you a hug. I don't know what's going wrong, but you're right. It's always the lowest tiers that complain the most.
So my immediate results were jaw-dropping. By the way, you said you had a prediction how many people would leave. Did you ever write that down? I forget what your prediction was.
I did. I texted you and I. Hold on. Keep talking. I'm going to look up in our past text. Let's see if I can find it.
So immediately, a whole bunch of people switched to annual memberships, which was great to see.
Right.
Except for the part that I'm going to talk about next, but they switched. A couple of people bumped themselves up to the $20 a month level where they get original art every 3 months. And part of that, I do have to admit, I just so happened to make a public Patreon post the week before showing what a bunch of the original art looked like and saying, you know, I really don't promote this tier often enough. And so it was kind of fresh in people's minds.
Right.
And a couple of people bumped themselves up to the $20 tier. Yet one of them said, yeah, I really enjoy what's going on here. He says, this is definitely worth a little bit more money. And if I get original art out of it too, so much the better. So and of course, people have been leaving as well. And I've gotten some new members that have come in just through the usual churn. All told, right now, the number of people who have left is a gross of 20. 20 people have canceled their accounts.
20 people have canceled,
accounts.
Okay.
Yeah. Which you also have to remember, two people increased their accounts, so that offsets two of them. And I've had a number of other people that have come in from there too. So call it a net of 18 so far.
Net of 18. I'm actively looking through my phone to see if I can see my prediction. I thought that it was going to be, I think, around 10 people. So a little bit higher than my guess, but. Overall, Brad, has this been a net positive to your income or a net negative to your income?
Don't even get me started. Again, I could lose 80 more and still do better. Right.
Right.
I mean, this has absolutely been a net positive. And my biggest complaint, Dave, is that I'm going to find in another few weeks, I'm going to kick myself for not doing it sooner. In other words, I should have, and we should probably talk about this. I waited until the very beginning of a month to do that because of that 31-day grace period.
Right.
And I'm starting to wonder if maybe it's not smarter to do it in the middle of the month so that you've got that next payment update happens in the middle of the 31 days.
Right.
And then the next one goes after that.
Okay, check your phone. I just copied and pasted and retexted you the text from a few weeks ago. It says Patreon price update. So yes. I did the math and said Brad could lose 115 people and it would still up your income. You could lose 115 people. And so this was at the height of Brad's nervousness, right?
Oh, such anxiety.
So Dave predicted 15 to 50 people will step away, but I was leaning towards 15. And how many net did you say walked
18.
Away?
18 net.
Come on. My prediction was pretty good.
Pretty good. Well, and assuming now I know that a bunch of people are going to dip out at the very last minute at the end of the month. And by the way, that happens whether I'm changing rates or not. Like we get that end of the month dip. But then, you know, the thing is, if I was on the other side of the screen here and I was consulting with somebody, my advice to that person would be very matter of fact. Your job is to do such good work that it makes it hard for the people to decide to leave.
Right.
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 That's what my advice to me has to be. Keep your head down. Keep working. Put the good work out. Thank you, because I'm telling you, there was a couple times I just called up like with a 1,000-yard stare in my eyes going, oh, my God, I don't know whether I'm doing the right thing or not. And Dave talked me off the ledge several times during that time.
But this is where this is universal to every single one of us as cartoonists is this same fear and these same doubts and anxieties happen every time you set the price for a book. Every time you're at a convention and someone says, oh, that print is cool for $10. Would you take $5 for it? And then you have to mentally say to yourself, no, I'm holding my ground on my prices. This is worth it. You know, that kind of thing. All of these sorts of decisions are the exact same sort of imposter syndrome and anxiety and self-doubt that Brad and I felt just in raising prices for a longstanding, super valuable patronage system that we use on Patreon. But having done it, it made a difference for Brad and I of thousands of dollars of income that are sorely needed. So this was well worth it. And the people that were supporting ended up being happy, like at a 98% level, that the support was still possible and it's still able to maintain that price, and all that worked out fine.
Yeah, but going back to that document I was telling you about, I also had pre-done questions and answers. Like
God, this is me asking someone out on a date in high school. Yes, I would have the chart of questions and answers.
I had, if they say this, I say that.
That's me in high school asking a girl out on a date. Oh my God.
It was a whole flow chart of arguments. Do you know that for the show, this is the first time I've opened up that Google Docs. I haven't had to use it at all. Yeah. Most of the people have just been like, oh yeah, I get that. And the biggest thing I've had to deal with, and we should deal with this just on because of the nature of this show, we need to talk about this last part before we wrap up this topic, and it's this. Remember that note that I wrote to Patreon support? And I said, if I do this, if I raise my rate, will my backers have 31 days during that grace period to lock the old rate into their annual subscription?
Right.
And the answer I got back was yes. So I increased my rate. I made my announcement. A bunch of people jumped up to the annual subscription. And a couple of them started sending me emails saying, hey, when I do the annual subscription, it's using the $12 and not the $10. And I said, it shouldn't be doing that. Patreon said that they're going to do it the other way. You should be able to lock in that rate. And then I see everybody that has done that annual subscription, they were charged the $12. Patreon overcharged them. Now, some of them are like, nah, that's fine. Some of them are like, not. Some of them dipped out before.
Feel kind of bait and switchy. Yeah, exactly.
Because
right,
it's like, wait a minute, Brad said it would be 10 and it's 12. So a bunch of them have written me and said, hey, what's up here? I copy and pasted the screenshot saying, this is what I was told from Patreon. So of course, you know what you got to do then, because Patreon a lot of times listens to users more than they listen to creators. So my go-to is I'm going to get in touch with Patreon support at the same time you need to get in touch with Patreon support. And if they have a whole lot of people calling their attention to this thing, this is what they'll be told. And as I'm waiting for a note from Patreon support writes back to one of my users saying, oh yeah, it looks like the creator, Brad Geiger, increased their rate too soon. And they'll have to wait for another 31 days before they can increase it again.
No.
That doesn't make any sense. Too soon. Too soon for who? I pushed the button. There's no too soon. Yeah. I pushed the fuck. And I have this. So now I've got, and now my person from Patreon support says that they are putting it up the chain to the people that are in charge of this section of the business. That was, I don't know, about a week ago. Still haven't heard back. So now I've got a bunch. We should tell people to be prepared for this until Patreon gets their shit together. The official word for Patreon is that they can lock in their rate. They can't. I can tell you firsthand, they can't. If they get that annual rate, they're going to be charged the new rate. And you need to be prepared for that. What Patreon's going to, you know, it's going to happen, Dave, and you're going to laugh at me, but it's the only honest thing to do. I think each of those people that bumped up got overcharged like $20. I'm going to have to offer to write them a check. Because I said it was going to be one way because of the way Patreon said it was going to be, they got overcharged. The only honest thing to do is to offer to write them a check and cover the difference, because otherwise I'm the guilty one. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah. Ultimately you have to maintain this relationship, not be Patreon. Also, just to reemphasize that as much as we love Patreon, and we do, and as much as we appreciate Patreon, and we do, sometimes it feels like three kids in a trench coat running that company.
Oh, my God.
I also, like Brad, made super sure to be very clear in my communication that I was raising prices and this is what was going to happen. But Patreon, I guess, because some creators are not as well in tune with being communicators, Patreon generates an auto email that goes out, right?
Yes.
That says, hey, your prices just got raised. Well, I don't know who coded this auto email, but it grabbed the annual price and made it monthly when in the communication, not in the actual execution, but in the communication, right. And said, like, let's say you were backing for $3 a month, right? So that would be $39 or $36 rather a year. And so we would say, okay, Brad, you're now paying, because of the price change, $36 a month. And all these readers of mine were like, wait, what? And yeah. So I had to then communicate over Patreon's communication. So just be prepared as you do this. As I always say, Patreon is a very well-meaning company. I like Patreon, but they are sometimes three kids in a trench coat in terms of execution. So just be careful and communicate well with your audience, because Patreon sometimes is not the greatest. Anyway. Both Brad and I wanted to share this with you, to share that even cartoonists, even artists 25 years in, can feel the same insecurities, the same anxieties, the same imposter syndrome in dealing with audiences that have proven over years to love their work and want to support their work. And even with people that are demonstrably supportive of our careers, we are anxious about asking for what we're worth. And so know that this is a universal among artists. You are not alone, but it is worth pushing through on setting the prices for your book, setting the prices for your Kickstarter, setting the prices at conventions and at Patreon, because you are worth the amount that you want to ask for as an artist. Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute to stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, we're going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
When you do, you're going to get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And exclusive Patreon posts that go even deeper on Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, which is a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, we get it. No worries.
Yeah, listen, you can still support the show by rating us wherever you get your podcasts.
Just leave a 5-star review and a few kind words.
That, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics.
Dave, we've got some really exciting news to share now about what's coming up this August.
Oh, this August, the National Cartoon Society, as everyone knows, has their big Reuben Award weekend. This is the weekend where obviously the Reuben Awards are given out, but it's also sort of a trade event in the sense that we have continuing seminars, talks, panels, featured speakers that come in and do best practices, pro tips, trade craft secrets, all sorts of stuff. So it's like 3 days of talks and then the big weekend award show. And as part of the weekend of talks, Brad and I are doing not one, but two Comic Lab live events at the NCS weekend.
Absolutely. And we're looking forward to this. We'll have a guest list that we will share with you shortly. But what they want us to do at the Comic-Con Museum is to do two full Comic Lab shows back to back with different guests in both of them, because the hall only seats 138, I think,
right,
they said.
Right.
So basically what they're doing is they're taking people around and doing different events on shifts. So the first bus load is going to drop in. That's going to be our audience for show number one. Then they're going to be whisked off to do another event, and bus load number two comes in for show number two.
And as a part of that, this is all taking place in the brand new San Diego Comic-Con Museum, which is so Comic-Con, as you guys know, is a nonprofit organization. Wink. So as part of that being a nonprofit, they've built this big museum about Comic-Con. I've never been. Brad's never been. But apparently there is this gorgeous new theater with this huge stage, proscenium arch, well lit, mic'd. And so we're going to have a great location to give a talk. And we're basically going to interview different guests over different hours, all of which you should be able to hear. But we want to mention this to you because this is now 2 years in a row that we're talking at the NCS Reuben weekend. And I think if the fates are smiling, we're going to make this a regular affair. So if you've not yet applied to the NCS, you want to head over to Reuben.org and get your application in for future years and join us at next year's Reuben weekend.
Yeah. And this year we're going to be there August 22nd through the 24th. Did we mention that yet?
No, but we did mention also that the talk itself is on the 22nd. So you're going to want to see both talks on the 22nd. So get there on time.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. We're really looking forward to it. So, Dave, speaking of a lot of fun and speaking of numbers, I see you got it tattooed across your forehead backwards so you can see it when you're shaving in the morning. It says 1228. What does
that
mean?
That's right. That is my booth number for San Diego Comic-Con, which is also coming up and is also in San Diego. And unlike the museum, is also not nonprofit. just a reminder to all Comic Lab listeners, whenever you come out and see Brad and I in person, we have these pins that we give away to listeners for free. They're the Let's Talk Comics silver pin. It's really cute. Yeah. So do come out to San Diego Comic Con. Come say hi. Come get the free high five at the booth and the pin. I am at booth 1228 at San Diego Comic Con all 5 days.
All right. So, Dave, it's time for a question from one of our Comic Lab Patreon backers. And this one comes in from somebody who actually took his turn in the Comic Lab critique channel, and the upshot of what happened there, I think, led to his question that he wrote in. And okay, I got permission to talk about the comic that he had critiqued because I think it all winds together. So here's his question. It says, colloquialisms, idioms, can they be effectively used without alienating your audience? And here's what he's talking about. Being based in Scotland, my strip is set in a fantasy version of Scotland, and I enjoy sprinkling in some Scottish language, designs, and themes. I shared my latest strip on the Critique Channel Comic Lab Discord server, and some people found a few words I used confusing. I then restructured some sentences to make them clearer without losing the flavor. But my question is, what do you think is the best way to preserve the character of my setting or my world without confusing and losing readers? After all, if they can't understand your comic, they won't read it. So, Dave, What advice, what guidance can we give this person? He wants to maintain the flavor of Scotland and Scottish culture without confusing people who may not be familiar with some of those colloquialisms and idioms.
Right. Well, oddly enough, as a sci-fi writer, I actually think I have some good advice for this because regionalisms, localisms, idioms, and sort of phrases that exist only for a certain people or for a certain region are not unlike, Brad, the phrases and names and places and concepts that exist in sci-fi or fantasy in the sense that, yes, like in Dune, you can talk about the Bene Gesserit, but you have to kind of couch for the first five or six times that you use the phrase Bene Gesserit, what that is. What are the contextual clues that help a reader remember what the Bene Gesserit is? What do they do? What is their philosophy? What is their purpose here? Maybe even as far as how do you read and pronounce the damn thing? You know, for example, I pronounce Hermione Hermoine the first four books. Mentally, I pronounced it Hermoine until I went to a movie and I was like, wait, it's Hermione? What I'm saying here is that sci-fi and fantasy authors can actually give us a lot of instruction on how to introduce new concepts, different concepts, unique concepts and words and phraseologies to a readership that might not be familiar with you. Don't you think, Brad, that there's a parallel there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you've got and I think you hit it on the head with context clues. Right. We always go back to watching Star Trek and Geordi is down there saying, oh, I think I've got the solution, Captain. If I take and reverse the ionic field of our phaser torpedoes, we might be able to overload the circuits until finally all of the ionization. And then somebody cuts him off and says, you mean pop it like a balloon? Yes, that's exactly it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yes. Context clues. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you get it. You get it. But this goes even deeper. I'm going to go into this here a little bit because I got permission to do this. So you don't think I'm picking on the poor guy. Here's what we've got here. The first panel of the comic, a post office character, like a letter carrier, is talking to a short furry carrier, okay? Or a short furry character, okay? So the postman says, ear, Dunder. You got a letter. And immediately I'm like, ear, Dunden. Ear is spelled apostrophe E-R-E.
Right.
Dunder is this character's name. Now, from my way of thinking, you've got a half of a second, a fraction of a half of a second on social media. If you're going to build an audience on social media, you've got to capture that person immediately, right? Only got a fraction of a fraction of a sentence. Ear Dunder, I argued, if you wanted to put a murder confession into a comic strip, you would want Ear Dunder to be the first words in that comic strip, because right. you could live a life of old age and happiness knowing that no one's ever going to read the comic or the murder confession in panel 4, because they're going to nope out at Ear Dunder.
Right.
And tell me if you agree. I get it that he wants it to be like Ear Dunder, but colloquially, but especially since that was the first words in the first panel. And I didn't like ear because that's a roadblock, and I don't need to know this character's name for the punchline. So I wanted Dunder out and I wanted ear out. Right. In fact, I was suggesting you got a letter. Does that drain the flavor out of that first panel?
No, but I will say this. If you're going to sprinkle in regionalisms, I think, to Brad's point, maybe better not at the beginning or the end of a sentence where there's fewer contextual clues, if you know what I mean. Like, the words around a word help support and lift up and frame a word. That literally is the contextual framing, is what's around it. So in the middle of a phrase, that I feel like is the better place to drop the, you know, a regionalism or an idiom or a unique phraseology. Or if you have ear continually appearing in the strip, make sure that the first 20, 30, 40 times that it appears, there's a little bit of context of what and how you're supposed to approach that. Did you, Brad, just out of a completely separate thing, did you ever read the X-Men when Banshee was in it?
Yeah, I've read a couple of those. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Did you ever read The New Mutants when Rain Sinclair, Wolfsbane, she was the, Rain Sinclair, they often leaned into it. I felt like a little too much.
I
don't know what the hell she's saying. Like, I want to like this character. She's too Scottish. I don't know what the hell's going on here. And for all English speakers around the world, Scots are unique wrinkle in the English language in that they have said, you know what, we like about 60% of this, but 40% of this, it's a cold rewrite. We're doing a cold rewrite on the English language. We've got our own phrases. It's not unlike, I'm trying to think of an Americanism or Canadianism where I guess the deep, deep South would be the closest I could come to a regional accent that you're like, oh, you know what, maybe New Orleans. If you're near New Orleans with someone who's like 80 years old and they've been speaking it the way they used to speak it,
yes,
it can be tricky, don't you think? To
with that Cajun flavor,
strong Cajun, like most places in the world, the accents and the regionalisms are disappearing as mass media more and more infects the way we think and talk.
Oh yeah,
but I feel like the deep, deep South and Scotland. But anyway, Rain Sinclair in New Mutants and Banshee, who is Irish in X-Men. Every once in a while, whoever was writing them would lean in on the regionalisms. Yeah. And me, as a 12-year-old kid, I was like, I don't know what the hell's going on here. And so I think you're right, Brad, about you've got to put contextual clues. You got to minimize it. And I think as a sci-fi writer, you have to sprinkle it in the same way that a sci-fi or a fantasy writer would sprinkle in a weird group or a warrior class or a sci-fi ship or a concept in sci-fi or fantasy or the way that a magic system works. And you have to do it a little bit hand-holdy for the first couple times you do it for the reader.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because we're still in the first panel here. But there's so much here. This really became a microcosm that fascinated me. Postman says, "Ear Dunder, you got a letter." Dunder says, "I don't have a letterbox." And then the post carrier says, "Just Avid." Now, I had less problems with just Avid, again, because it was in the middle. I get that that's just Avid, right?
Yeah.
still not crazy about it, but less of a visceral reaction than for the first two words of the comic, right?
Right.
So you've got a letter. I don't have a letterbox. And then the postman says, just have it. At which point Dunder says, had on.
That one, I don't know. Had on? What is that?
Had on. And then starts working, right? Now, I brought that up in the Discord, and the cartoonist says, oh, well, that's a Scottish colloquialism. That's would be similar to hang on, right?
Well, I'm looking it up online. I can't even find had on. Oh, a simple and past participle of have on. Okay, so is that what they're saying?
Yes.
A past participle of have on. Okay, had on. I've never heard that. Okay, keep going.
So I said, that's got to go. That's got to go. You can't have him saying had on. That loses everybody. Everybody that stuck with you past ear dunder is ditching with had on. Right. Which is, by the way, insulting to somebody who's Scottish,
right?
Because their idioms and colloquialisms is just as valid.
Totally valid. Yes. Yeah.
So I could totally understand if my reaction to that was one that you know, raised some ire. And then in the very end, just to really show you what's going on here, this character Dunder saws a hole in his door and says, now, since he didn't have a letterbox, now he's got a letterbox because he's sawed a rectangular hole in his door.
Okay.
I said, that's not a letterbox. That's a mail slot. The guy says, I guarantee you no one around here is calling it a mail slot. That's a letterbox. I said, it's a mail slot. But in Scotland, when you have that hole in your door that the mail comes through that I would call a mail slot, they're calling that a letterbox.
Right.
If I get past ear dunder and if I get past had on, now I've got to get past the fact that he's calling a mail slot a letterbox. And a letterbox to me would be a box that you put letters in. And like if you ever lived at an apartment complex, they had a letterbox there where all the mail goes in. You get yours out of your slot. So I said, to me, that's a top to bottom rewrite.
Right.
And from the other standpoint, it drains all of the colloquialism out of it. Right. It drains all of the Scottish flavor. It takes out the ear dunder. It takes out had on. Now we're calling this letterbox a mail slot or a mail slot a letterbox. What's the right answer? Right. How do you answer this correctly? And by the way, I'm not sure I know. I've got my thoughts. I got a thought I'm going to share. But in the meantime, how would you answer this? How are you going to keep the colloquialism without confusing half your audience?
It's tricky, and I'm actually going to switch gears to answer this question because Brad and I often talk about how writing to specificity and writing to what you is makes it uniquely yours and uniquely for you and by you is very often the key to gaining an audience. Mm-hmm. But it's a weird trade-off when the language itself is also what might be limiting that audience grow. Like, and so much like we say, write for yourself, but vaguely have a sense of an audience in mind. The sort of trade-off here in terms of mail slot versus postal box. What was the phrase you were using?
Letterbox and mail slot.
A letterbox. Yeah. In some respects, maybe you have to choose your battles in writing for the one or two regionalisms that you would like to teach the audience or sprinkle in or use, because it does make a key difference versus the one that doesn't need to be the one you fought over. It's like, you know, if there's a parallel choice that say both the majority of the English speaking world uses and Scotland uses, well, of course, default to that. But if there's one that like, if you use it, no Scottish person would understand it. That's going to be trickier. You know what I mean? Because it is a comic strip in Scotland, or at least in a fantasy version of Scotland. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, let's just talk about the numbers of this. So population of Scotland, I think, is around, what, 5 million, 6 million people?
That sounds about right.
And the population of the English-speaking world writ large is about 1 or 2 billion people. Now, not all those are native speakers. That's people in France that have learned English and all that sort of stuff. But 1 to 2 billion people versus 5 million, you can absolutely 100% make a career just out of Scottish readers. You could tap into the huge passion of Scottish people who would be like, holy crap, it's a comic strip written by us, for us, about us.
Right.
And I am diving in deep and I'm supporting this thing all the time. That is a totally valid career choice. It's a totally valid artistic choice. You can go that route. You could also say, no Scottishisms. I'm going to go the broader, world global English. I'm going to use that. And I'm going to try to tap in the 1 to 2 billion people, but they'll feel less passionate about it because it's just one more, not that it's generic, but one more generic English phrasing and ideologies and or not ideology, idioms. Jeez Louise. and so there's a third option, which is threading the needle. And I think that's where Brad and I would recommend, which is use Scottishisms, use the unique and wonderful language that Scotland has to offer, but sprinkle it in and handhold us so that we can learn it. Because I will say this, Australia and New Zealand, like Americans and the global English world have come to learn Australian and Kiwi language because of shows like Neighbours or This or That, where mass media has brought it to us. And we've come to love certain Australianisms, certain New Zealand phrases. But there hasn't yet been a huge breakthrough of Scottish mass media, don't you think, Brad? Yeah. So it's a little trickier. And I think you just have to know going in that you're going to need to handhold more with things like Mail Slot or Letterboxd.
Yeah, although I think Mike Myers did a really good attempt back in the 90s of exposing us to a little bit more Scottish humor. But you and I think, kind of agree on the big swings. In other words, every choice you make as a writer, is your choice to make based on where your passions are.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And you have to make this choice, knowing full well that each one of those choices also comes with a consequence, right? So you've got, in my opinion, two choices, two main choices. And then, like Dave points out, a third, you can lean way into the Scottish colloquialisms and know that you're not going to have a very big portion of your audience growth happen in places like the United States. But you might, and how many times have we seen the benefits of a niche audience?
Yes.
Where you might have, if the work is good, if the work is connecting with its audience, its intended audience, if those punchlines are sharp and if they're landing, if your writing is super strong, you can make a very good career out of a niche audience. And you can just lean into the Scottish thing and says, I don't need the United States. I've got Scotland and I'm going to build my niche audience here. That's option number one. Option number two is you jump into the critique channel on Discord and say, do I have any words here that are confusing to a wider audience? Because I think when I say United States, to a great degree, probably 90-95%, that's going to include Great Britain and British English, although there's a few idioms that don't quite crisscross there. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You can say, are there things that is keeping that from communicating, and then make the changes as necessary? Or you can do what Dave is talking about and try to meet that out little by little and do the hand-holdy thing. Those are all valid choices. And the only thing that I'm going to insist is that each of those choices have consequences, good and bad, right? Pros and cons. And just be honest with yourself about what the consequences are to those choices you're making, right? This is one of those times that, this is something that goes in the back of my mind when I hear somebody saying that they feel like social media is shouting into their void, or they blame the algorithm. It's like, all those things are true. Yeah. And as an artist, I've made choices, you've made choices, this question asker is making choices, and all of those choices have consequences that are just as important, just as significant as algorithms and all this other stuff. So my only thing is take a really honest look at the choices, the artistic choices you're making, understand the consequences, and then go straight ahead.
Yeah.
Then after you made that choice, barrel through, just like kind of the top of the show where we were saying once Dave and I made that choice to raise prices, there was no turning back. There's no second guessing. Once you've made that choice, then barrel through.
Yeah. I want to get a yes and Brad on that in that. And I want to talk about Kate Beaton, who no longer does Hark a Vagrant, but when she was doing the really strongly history based comic Hark a Vagrant. She would, for the most part, I'd say 80% of the time, have enough generally understood historical or literary references where the average audience member could, you know, knew it right offhand. Mm-hmm. But then every once in a while, and rightly so, to her credit as writing what she wanted, she would have a topic where I or others might not know it as well. For example, she had a whole series, I think it was on the Emperor of Mexico. And I was not as well versed of that period of Mexico. I just didn't know much about it. So at first I went to Wikipedia, and then, believe it or not, I checked out a book from the library on that whole period of Mexico history, all because of this comic strip, right? And so I say that because if you thread this needle well, where you communicate to broader 1 to 2 billion English speakers as the sort of English as the lingua franca, but then you also sprinkle in with enough hand-holding the Scottishisms, you might be able to do what Kate did for me with Hark a Vagrant, which is actually spark a greater love and a greater interest in all things Scottish from this one thing. You know what I mean? It could be sort of the gateway drug that gets people really passionate about. And I will say this, speaking only for Americans, Americans kind of want to love Scotland. Don't you think, Brad? In general, like there is a good cultural resonance among Americans from a couple of key media moments, Austin Powers being one of them, where Americans kind of lean towards liking the Scots and Scottish culture. And I say this as a comparison, and our Welsh readers are going to get mad at me, but Americans, for the most part, don't give two shits about the Welsh. Like, we don't think about the Welsh. We don't think about Wales. We kind of don't. We never think about the Welsh language. But Scotland somehow, a little bit like Ireland, has a sort of an impact on American culture. Don't you think, Brad? So I think if you do this right, you could a little bit entice at least Americans into learning or wanting to learn more about Scotland.
I want to agree with you in the worst way. I want to be a good partner.
Okay.
But here's the problem.
But can we at least agree that I absolutely insulted a couple million Welsh right there? Just completely fucked off and threw the Welsh under the bus on that. Like,
it was worth it for that alone.
But you have to admit, Americans never think about Wales. We don't think about the Welsh. But like, if you say Scotland or Scottish, like Americans,
double down on that. The first insult wasn't bad enough. Let's bring it around for another run.
I'm sorry, Wales. I have Welsh friends. I'm sorry.
Yes.
So here's friends. I literally
here's my
said
problem.
That.
Other than what you said about Wales, here's my problem with that. Kate Beaton writes a comic about a lesser known point in history. She writes a good comic with a punchline that lands, and you go, "Oh, this is a topic I didn't know about," and you went up and read about it. Okay, now that's one thing. Here's what I just read. This other comic had phrases that were meaningless, like had on, had a mail box instead of a mail slot. It doesn't make sense. So the punchline doesn't land because all of this stuff lines up to bring me to a place where I have no idea what this person's talking about. And I'm not going to fall in love after having read a strip that I look at and go, well, that didn't make any sense at all.
Right.
On one hand, you've got Kate Beaton, who really knew how to write and wrote this really tight 4-panel, boom, boom, boom. Oh, I get what's happening there. Even though I'm not familiar with this moment in history, I'm going to learn more about the history. On the other hand, you've got I don't know what happened in the first panel. I don't know what happened in the second panel.
Yeah, that's true.
I get to the last panel, it falls apart, and I'm not going to fall in love for that. So I don't know that in good conscience we can tell this person that they can expect Kate Beaton's outcome.
No, I'm not. You're right.
Am I being mean?
No, I think a better comparison is probably the very idiosyncratic and in-world language of maybe Penny Arcade in terms of gaming. If you're not a gamer, does that? Do you think that's a worthwhile parallel to talk about?
Perhaps.
But here's where I'm going with this. I never really read Penny Arcade because I didn't get 80 to 90% of them. I was like, I didn't know the context. Yeah. I didn't know the game. I was never enough of a gamer to know the specific leet speak or, you know, unique language of gamers. It was kind of always like over my head. Right. So I never really read it. But for the couple hundred million people who are English speakers that do dive into video games, that language really spoke to them. Right. And so that's kind of what I'm leaning at here, which is that for Scottish speakers, if you lean into it, you might be able to get, and let's be honest, you only need about 100,000 readers in Scotland to really make a huge go of this. Maybe lean into that. That's also a very valid choice of like leaning into the culture and the language that really resonates with you. That's a totally valid choice.
That I would sign off on 100%. Go for that niche audience that's built in Scotland. In other words, here's what this poor guy's trying to do. He's writing stuff. He's trying to write humor, right? And you and I both know from firsthand experience, learning to write humor is hard. It's going to take this person a long time to learn how to land a punchline. Because this person, I think, is an artist first and a writer second, right? So now he's trying to write a punchline. And as hard as that is, now he's got words that mean one thing to him, another thing to me, another thing to somebody somewhere else.
Right.
And he's trying to serve too many masters. Right. So I would say what you're saying is probably the best way to go forward. And that is to say, listen, you're going to lean way into your Scottish heritage. You're going to build a niche audience in Scotland. People in the United States, by and large, are not going to be part of your audience building, and that's okay. You know, some of them are going to be in the know and others aren't. And that's, I think you've got the right answer there. Instead of trying to rewrite this stuff, it would be like me trying to rewrite something in French, not knowing any French idioms, not knowing any French culture, right?
Yeah.
And every time I write somebody saying, oh, well, you can't have them holding up their teacup with their left hand because nobody would do that. Right. And now I got to redraw that scene with the right hand for something that doesn't make any sense to me. I would find it very frustrating to be treated like that. So I think your best bet is to say, listen, I'm going to lean way into this. My audience is going to be a niche audience that's going to be concentrated right here in Scotland, and then go again, like I was saying, full steam ahead on that.
Yeah, and I just realized there's a fourth option that I didn't mention, and so I'm gonna throw this out, Brad, because maybe you have thoughts on this. I'm curious to hear what your thoughts on. The first option was to lean into your Scottishness, right, and go for that audience of potentially 5 to 6 million people, maybe a little bit more if you include worldwide diaspora of Scottish people.
Sure, sure.
The option two is to lean in towards broader global mercantile English, you know, the sort of lingua franca that all international English speakers would understand. The third option, again, a hybrid of the two with a contextual clues. The fourth option, and I don't know why I didn't think about this, there is a recent book out by Lonnie Mann called Gaytheist, which is about a young gay man growing up in an Orthodox Jewish house. First of all, it's a beautiful book, and I really recommend
it. You mentioned it before.
Did I mention it before? Okay, anyway. But one of the things Lonnie does really well in the book is, for someone like myself, who grew up with a Catholic understanding of religion, Lonnie explains certain Orthodox phrases, certain Orthodox habits, certain Orthodox rituals, family culture, community culture, specific synagogue culture, explains it in the book as he goes but sometimes it's just a quick little bada bing, bada boom, and you're back into the story. You know what I mean? But it's one little narration box. Do you think, Brad, that a narration slash explanation inside or adjoining the comic would be weird? Would it break the flow or the magic of a Scottish set fantasy story? Like, would that work?
For a long form story comic, I think that's a great way to do it. For a four panel humor based strip, I think that's death.
Yeah, you're probably right.
How many jokes after they're explained to you are funny? The answer is zero. Yeah. No jokes are funny after they're explained to you. Right? It either happens in a lightning bolt or it doesn't. So in that long form story, which probably isn't relying a whole lot on humor,
That's a really good way to handle
those situations. In a short form, punchline driven humor comic, I think that would be hot death.
You're right. Nothing kills humor more than explanations. What's that old thing about, it's like dissecting a frog. You figured out how the frog works, but now it's dead. So
now it's a dead frog.
Yes. Now you've explained how the joke or the language works, but now you've killed the mood of the punchline. You're right. Yeah, that's exactly what would happen. All right, so option four is off the table.
Let's not do option four.
I think Brad and I would lean either towards, like Brad was saying, lean in towards uniquely hitting that Scottish audience and going after those 5, 6, 7 million people, or leaning towards a hybrid approach with contextual clues, strong contextual clues, and maybe gentle explanations and repetitiveness of use for certain key words. Gosh, this is a tricky problem, though. I don't know that we have a satisfying ending at the end of this.
My thing, if I was going to give this person advice, go with number one. Lean way into Scottish.
Really? That's your. I don't know. Yep. I don't know that I feel good about that.
Oh, because. I don't know that I would be able to work the other way. Like every time I wrote a sentence, I'd have to run it past an American to see if I said letterbox and it should be mail slot.
Right.
Could you imagine? And there's a million of these little things that don't line up between the language left and right. I think this person leans way into Scottish, goes nuts, realizes there's never going to be a big American audience for it. But, you know, 5.5 million Scots, that's plenty of people to try and build an inch audience out of.
Right.
You know what I mean?
At this point, now that we've put a wrap on this topic, I would like to say, and if Matt, our editor, would like to put some soft music behind me on this, I just want to say, I love Wales. Wales, sometimes referred to as the land of song, which of course Cardiff as its population center and capital. There are 600,000 current Welsh speakers in Wales, all of which are learning this beautiful language and sharing what they know with the world. So both Brad and I and the entire Comic Lab community celebrate and welcome with open arms and hugs and kisses the land of Wales, this beautiful country that comprises 1/4 of the United Kingdom. Thank you so much, Wales, for existing and being as wonderful as you are. Brad and I love you and will always love Wales.
Oh, my God. Let me put you out of your misery, Dave. You've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics, making enemies in Wales, and making a living from comics.
Do you think we even have one listener in Wales, honestly?
Oh, I think we do. In fact, I think I know who it is. I swear to God.
I'll tell you that.
In fact, I think they're active on the Comic Lab Discord.
Oh, no. Are they really? You, oh, yes, God. Oh, God. Here I am insulting the whale, the land of song. Oh, no. Wales, what have I done? What have I done? Oh, no. Oh, God.
And making a living from comics.
This
is really thrown you, hasn't it?
Your hosts have been my friend Brad Geiger, who will not be getting arsenic sent to him in the mail from Cardiff. He's the editor of webcomics.com, and he's the creator of Evil Inc. at evilcomic.com.
And my kind-hearted friend, who has very little resistance to poisons, the co-director of the comics documentary Stripped. Oh, they've been talking about Stripped again. There's been a big resurgence. I've seen it on social media.
Yeah, because it's the 10-year anniversary, apparently. Yeah. I totally forgot. Wow.
Oh, my gosh. So Dave was the co-director of that, and the cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com, and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And of course, this show will not be invited to Cardiff Comic Con. Cardiff Comic Con, Wales' biggest Comic Con, where they look forward to shiving Dave Kellett in the back the next time he's there. Oh. This episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media.
Meanwhile, whoever is in charge of the Wales Wikipedia page is seeing the biggest traffic they've seen in 3 months. Dave keeps going back to get more facts. If you love Comic Lab, you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, and you may hear your review featured on a future episode. And thank you so much for everybody giving us those 5-star reviews over there on Spotify. You are helping keeping us at the very top of the comics charts.
And Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So I will go ahead and say that twice. patreon.com/ cannot emphasize enough how much I love Wales.
Hello, everybody. Brad Geiger here. You know, taking a serious moment among all of the fun and frivolity, I just wanted to let you know that I have nothing to do with Dave Kellett, his personal opinion towards Wales, or any of the members of my family, work associates, anybody here at Evil Inc. We have nothing to do with Dave Kellett and his personal vitriol towards Wales. Why here at the Geiger family, often we take a moment on our family prayer and say a couple of nice words just for the people of Wales and especially people who are members of this particular Welsh village. Oh, our favorite Welsh village called Caergwaet. Sometimes
no,
we pray to the good Lord
above.
No,
you were doing so good.
A lot of times we'll pray that the good Lord sends them a couple vowels they can use in their language. But one thing is for sure, we are not associated in any way, shape, or form with Dave Kellett and his unbelievable hatred towards Wales and the Welsh
people. His unwarranted and unbelievable hatred for the
Welsh. We don't know where it comes from. We in this family, we love everyone, even the Welsh, even the people that Dave evidently can't stand.
Well done, Brad. Well done. You will not find yourself murdered by the Welsh. Good job. You have successfully navigated those waters. Good job. Oh.